Welcome to Outspoken Voices, a podcast by and for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer parents, people with LGBTQ parents, future parents, and everyone else who is part of our family journeys. I'm your host, Emily McGranahan, and I am the Director of Family Engagement with Family Equality Council. It will come as no surprise to listeners of this podcast that I love LGBTQ family stories, and so does Family Equality Council. Hearing them, telling them, and creating new platforms to share them. We love it all. So anytime there is a new book or resource that tells the stories of people with LGBTQ parents in their very own words, I just get so excited. Growing up, I really often felt like the only child of LGBTQ parents in my community, and there really wasn't any in mainstream consciousness that I was seeing. In the past 20 years, there has been a clear increase in published books by people with LGBTQ parents, or really featuring their stories. One new anthology of stories of fellow queer spawn is Raised by Unicorns, Stories from People with LGBTQ Parents, edited by Frank Lowe, a gay dad. It is filled with stories by people with LGBTQ parents, including author and activist Jenny Rain. So today, Jenny is with me to talk more about the book and why amplifying the stories of people with LGBTQ parents is really so important to her. So Jenny recently completed her first book. Her passion is to serve the LGBTQ community, and that began in the 1970s when her biological father met his now husband. Jenny works to build bridges between the church and LGBTQ families in a manner that promotes reconciliation and healing. So welcome, Jenny.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm grateful to be involved.
Thanks. And this is the question I love to ask everybody, and I already alluded to it a little bit in your bio there, but who is in your family and how and how was it formed?
So I was born in 1970, and so back in the day, there wasn't an opportunity for kids to be born into or to be adopted into LGBTQ families. And so my biological dad, who you'll hear me refer to as Poppy, and my mom were married in the 60s, and then they had me in 1970. My dad met his partner, who is now his husband, in 1977. I have a fantastic picture of them where my dad looks like, Welcome Back, Cotter, the main guy from Welcome Back, Cotter, and Denzel, who's my first stepdad, has his, like, ginormous 70s glasses. and then I have one at their wedding, which I actually took. And so they met in the 70s. Obviously, things were very hush-hush back then. My mom met her partner, who is now her husband, in the 80s. So I've got two stepdads, one named Denzel and one named George. My biological parents divorced in 1975, but I really had kind of the best of both worlds. They shared custody. My dad was a primary caretaker of me in the home, and then he really stayed super involved after they got divorced. I had the best of both worlds because I had parents who wanted and cared deeply about being involved.
And where were you growing up?
So I was in the Midwest. I actually grew up in Peoria, Illinois, and went to college at University of Iowa. And so I was smack dab in the middle of, you know, very white, very conservative, very cisgender, heteronormative land. And back in the 70s, you didn't talk about it. I mean, there were other families like me, but they were very closeted, very hidden. And so connecting with those other families was, you know, a little bit of a monumental task. It's a little different for kids nowadays, which I'm so happy for. But back when I was growing up, it definitely was, it was isolating. My dad moved out to Washington, D.C. when I was probably 10-ish. And, you know, I hated having him that far away. But the one thing that he did is he kind of opened the world for me to see that not everybody was like they were in the Midwest. Not to slam the Midwest, but it's a different world between the East Coast and the Midwest. And DC was very gay friendly. It still is a very gay friendly place. And so I had, you know, I spent growing up during the school year, I went to school in Illinois, and then every break I would spend that time with my dad's. And so you know, again, the best of both worlds.
Yeah. So did you know of other families like yours then growing up? It was a monumental task to really find and connect with one another. Were you able to do that? And if so, how did you find one another?
I vaguely remember some families, but the families that we ran into were primarily in the DC area. There wasn't anybody in our circle, our regular circle, that had LGBTQ parents. If most of them that I ran across were kids of moms, mm-hmm. not as much kids of dads. But nobody that I developed, you know, a long-standing relationship with or had any kind of a kinship with, where I could say, oh yeah, they get my rainbow family. They mm-hmm. get the experience that I'm experiencing. It wasn't until I was 44 years old and met my friend Sierra. She has dads, and she's really the first person when I was 44 that I was able to share at a deep level what it was like kind of growing up with dads and the challenges. And she's also a woman of color, and so she has that added, you know, complexity of battling what it's like to be a child with dads, and then battling what it's like to be a child with dads who happens to be a person of color, which mm-hmm. that's a whole nother layer to the, you know, to everything. So.
Absolutely. How did you tell your story really at all in those sort of intervening years between your dad coming out and age 44? you know, and then did that have any impact on the desire to tell your story? And now through writing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it definitely informs my advocacy and where I am now. I didn't talk about my dad probably from when I was a very young child up until I quote unquote came out in college. And I wrote mm-hmm. a paper. It was called My Little Secret. And even in the paper, I didn't ever say the words, you know, my dad is gay. Mm-hmm. But that was very much a pivotal point for me, because it's the first time I was able to in public, you know, say the words. Because I mean, I can remember I was in Catholic school when my parents divorced, and I remember the nuns like gathering around me and praying that daddy would come home. And I'm like, oh honey, yeah, that's not gonna happen. But you know, so it just, you didn't talk about it in the 70s. And then in the mm-hmm. 80s, when AIDS happened, to talk about it was to just bring incredible shame and ridicule upon yourself as a child, because, oh, your dads must have AIDS, or, oh, are they mm-hmm. dying from AIDS, or, oh, you know, they're a plague on society. And then in the 90s, when I was, you know, stepping into college, it was the Moral Majority and Pat Robertson. And, you know, so it was pushing that message of abomination and all of that mm-hmm. to the extreme. So really, the first time I came out about my family was in when I was in college, so in the 90s. And then really, I didn't start talking about it on the regular until the first boyfriend that I dated in 1994, I think. And I had to break up with him to tell him that my dads were gay. And he was so funny. He was like, oh yeah, I already knew that, because your dad had those funny purple tube socks. And so, yeah, I knew that. And I was like, whatever. but it was, I mean, that's how kind of much of a, you know, staying silent was really trained into kids of and families, you know, rainbow families in the 70s and 80s. You just didn't talk about it. So yes, I believe that, and I fully embrace the importance of children telling their stories, because it's this act of healing and act of redemption that they get to do, mm-hmm. but it's also an act of education for communities, especially the church community. Like if we could create a community where kids could talk about their two moms or their two dads within the church, first of all, my mind would be blown if that could ever happen. But it's so important, because in them being able to talk about it, it normalizes their experience. Vicki Beeching said, you know, when you have the courage to tell your own story, you give others the courage to tell theirs. And that statement, I heard it in few years ago, really gave me kind of the final push to realize that my story telling in and of itself was a means of, you know, fighting the narrative and fighting the system that says rainbow families aren't normal. So I really believe in the importance of stories.
Absolutely. And it's interesting how different it sometimes feels today, because when I meet younger children, and especially people who live around the Boston area where I am, where it doesn't feel courageous, it just feels normal and safe and so standard for them, that even for me, having grown up in Massachusetts, but in the 90s and, you know, early 2000s, like, it still felt, it was still nerve-wracking for me to do that. And yeah, to have this, you know, within 10 and 15 years to see this shift where it just feels so safe and normalized, it is incredible, when at the same time it feels like other progress hasn't been made quite the same.
I totally agree. And honestly, just even hearing you say that is is music to my ears, because it should be normal, right? Mm-hmm. Love is love. And, you know, marriage is marriage. And so the ability to create a loving family is what creates the foundation for children to grow up in a healthy environment. And, you know, thousands of studies have shown, well, maybe not thousands, but like lots of studies have shown that what a child needs to grow up in a healthy, well-adjusted manner is love.
And what then has pushed you to tell your story in an increasingly public way, to have a chapter in this anthology, to be writing your own book?
So I had, I used to be a prolific blogger. I would blog every day, and I had an article that I posted called "Will They Laugh If I Call You Daddy? Growing Up with Gay Dads in an Evangelical World." And that post was grabbed by the WordPress. This was back when like WordPress.com was, you know, all the thing. They grabbed my post and put it on their dashboard, and it went viral-ish. Mm-hmm. I say viral-ish because I got like 1,000 hits in an hour, which to me, that's, you know, that's normative for some people. But for me, I was like, oh my gosh. And I was working in a very conservative church at the time, and obviously trying to change some of the narratives there. And I was like, I'm going to get fired. Well, I didn't get fired, but I had so many people on staff who I kind of pigeonholed as super conservative come up to me, and they're like, we are so proud of you for sharing your story. Your story needs to be told. Wow. So I wrote parts 2 and 3, and then that became the basis for the book that I wrote, which of the same title, Will I Laugh If I, you know, If I Call You Daddy. And I realized that the more I told my story, both to kids of LGBTQ parents and to the parents themselves, people would have this reaction to me, like their eyes would pop open and they would say, this story needs to get out there. People need to hear this. How have we not heard your voices mm-hmm. up until then? And, you know, I always want to say, well, you guys aren't paying attention because we've been here, mm-hmm. right? Family equality has been around for 30 plus years. We've been here,
right?
You know, but we've been on the margins of the margins. And so nobody's heard us. So I think I have always believed that children of LGBTQ families and parents have the ability to change the conversation in our society. And I believe that because whether you are LGBTQ yourself or whether you are, you know, cisgender, heterosexual, you have a voice that people who normally might not listen to that voice will listen to. And I know that because in the church, because I'm cisgender, heterosexual, I can enter into conversations where a person who is LGBTQ might not be allowed. And so we have a really important voice in the conversation, and we have a really important story to add to the LGBTQ community narrative. I think as a whole, kids of LGBTQ parents have been erased, unintentionally mm-hmm. erased, but still erased from both the LGBTQ conversation and the church's kind of normative family conversation. And yet our voices have the power to change the conversation for good. You know, I think about mm-hmm. The work that Family Equality did with the Voices of Children's Brief, of which I had incredible honor of being a part of.
Can you describe, like, what, for anyone who may not know, like, what that was?
Yeah. So in 2015, and correct me if I get my dates wrong, in 2015, I was invited by Family Equality to be a part of the Voices of Children brief. And the Voices of Children brief brought together, you know, hundreds of kids from all over the nation who spoke their own voice on behalf of why marriage equality was so critical for the nation to pass. And the brief was put together and walked up to the stairs of the Supreme Court and delivered as evidence to the Supreme Court on the importance of marriage equality. Well, what ended up happening from that is the Washington Post got a hold of our stories, and I ended up on the front page of the Washington Post. And the angle that the Post took was essentially how kids became the strongest argument for same-sex marriage. And that was a direct result of the Voices of Children's brief. Fast forward, if you listen to the audio of the SCOTUS case for marriage equality, the strongest argument, and honestly, the argument that I felt was the most persuasive, was about the welfare of the children. So that brief and the article and kind of the groundswell behind it, I think was just a fulcrum point upon which marriage equality turned. And so I was thrilled to be a part of that. And I was like, oh my gosh, kids' voices are finally getting some airtime and da 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 da. And then we fast forward a year and kids' voices have gone underground again, you know, and it's like, ah, we gotta, like, don't just co-opt our voices, you know, leverage our voices for good to change the conversation forever.
So, do you think some of that, it sounds like some of that is people maybe not understanding the validity and the importance of the stories of people with LGBTQ parents that, you know, I know I run up against people not identifying my experience as like part of the LGBTQ community as a whole, and that queer spun identity that I personally identify with, it's not visible. So it's often just negated then, even when
Totally.
sometimes when I try to explain why it's important.
Yeah, totally. And I, so yes, so much yes. So because I'm not LGBTQ, I'm erased from the LGBTQ community. And because I don't have quote unquote normal parents, I'm erased from the heteronormative family. So we experienced very much the same thing that our parents experienced from the perspective of marginalization. The only difference is we're erased from being seen as having a valid experience. And what's kind of much worse with the upcoming generations is there's this trend now in the, and let me first off start by saying I really believe millennials are going to change the world, and I'm so grateful for their voices because they are blowing the binary boxes, and I love what they're doing. One area where I feel that it is important for younger generations to hear from the kids of LGBTQ parents is to hear that when they say that kids of LGBTQ parents have to quote unquote earn their allyship, does untold emotional violence to kids like me, because in many cases, in most cases, we've endured the exact same prejudice and marginalization. The only difference is I've experienced it for about 3 decades longer than a millennial has. So while they weren't even a thought in their parents' mind, I was experiencing and bleeding for this cause.
So growing up, did you would you talk with your dad and your stepdad about some of what you were experiencing and seeing, or your sort of growing identity within the community?
They didn't know. So yeah, no, honestly, we didn't talk about it. And they didn't know about, so in Raised by Unicorns, I talk about what happened to me when I was an 11-year-old, on when I was walking down the boardwalk in Rehoboth Beach, where I directly experienced something that my dad's didn't. It was aimed at them, but the toxic sludge, so to speak, leaked on over to me because of, you know, catcalling and prejudice that was aimed, you know, that was aimed at my dad's. And they didn't even know that happened until 2015. And when they read my story, they cried. They were like, Oh my God, we had no idea. They remember the incident because I essentially turned mute at the end of it and I couldn't say anything. But they didn't realize the impact that that had on me. And I think because society, they created a comfortable, safe space for me to exist in a family atmosphere. And, God knows they tried. They would try and get me to talk, but society was telling me I didn't have the right to talk about it. Society was telling me I needed to stay silent and hide. And so as a result, I didn't talk much about it.
And so today, how do you now navigate and sort of advocate within the faith community you're currently in, and then also maybe with your family today?
Yeah. So there was not anything that I knew of called an affirming church when I was growing up. There was Dignity, which is an affirming expression of the Catholic Church, and that's what I would go to with my dad. We would go to Dignity, Washington. And then as I got older, even in, I live in Palm Springs, California, and so even in more liberal Palm Springs, there's only three LGBTQ churches in the Coachella Valley.
Wow.
So that's staggering when you think about the number, 60% of Palm Springs is LGBTQ, and there's only
Wow.
three churches, and there's thousands of non-affirming churches. So there's a huge need for churches to, reach into the community, and not just the LGBTQ individual, but also the family unit as a whole. So it has been bumps and scrapes, and it has been at times a bloody mess. And I actually came to my belief for full inclusion when I was working in a non-affirming church, and I will forever be grateful to that experience, because that kind of incubator of faith created a space for me to fight for my own beliefs and find my own story and narrative of why I believe that the truest concept of God that you can see is one of inclusion. If you look back to the vast witness of Scripture from Genesis to Revelation, it's of God radically welcoming the outsider, throughout the entire Scripture. And yet somehow we've kind of forgotten that along the way as churches. So when I find a church who has that expression of radical welcome and acceptance and love, I dive in with both feet.
Who are you maybe writing for in some of the different ways that you've written?
Yeah.
There's people who are new or potentially hostile to what you're trying to say. You've talked to those sort of audiences. There's also an audience of newer or younger generations of people with LGBTQ parents to really understand the legacy
Yeah.
of children growing up within LGBTQ families, that we have our own queer history as well, and parents to really understand that your story is important and unique, but your children's stories and their experiences are also important and also unique.
Yes. So I should have you write my book proposal, because that was such a perfect analysis of my personas. No, all of those audiences really, because I want parents, so starting with parents, I want parents to understand that their child will have two coming out processes. The child will come out for the family unit, which I had to do. This is my family. And then the child will come out for themselves as to whether they are LGBTQ or straight. And I had both of those coming out processes. I had to ask those questions of myself and, figure out. I will never forget the conversation with my dad, where I was like, "Dad, I'm looking at these things and I'm asking these questions because this is the environment I grew up in, and these are the things I'm learning." And I was like, "Dad, am I gay?" And he was like, "No, honey, you're not." And he kind of giggled, and I was like, "I'm serious." But every child asks that, whether they're, I think honestly, whether they're in a heterosexual family or an LGBTQ family. So we essentially have, maybe not every child, but a lot of
I
children.
know I did.
Yeah, right?
I was definitely, and the great thing was that I got to do it. I mean, obviously things change, but I would remember distinctly being in kindergarten and sitting in the car with while my mom was driving and saying, like, you know, like, I really like my best friend, but do I like her like her? Like, do I like her the way I like this other boy? And my, you know, and getting to have that parent sounding board of like, I don't know, honey, like, you know, I'm sure just like sweating out being, oh my gosh, my child is five and we're doing this already, you know?
Totally.
And then I got to keep, you know, but I got to keep doing it, and it got to continue to be safe to do it with people who knew me so well.
Right. Because, I mean, the first time you speak the words or ask the question, am I gay? I don't, whether you're straight or gay or anywhere on the spectrum, or whether you're struggling with like, I'm a girl or I'm a boy and you're on the gender identity spectrum, those are the most terrifying words, because society tells you that they're terrifying. Right. You know, society tells you that to question if you're gay is wrong. So having the scaffolding of a safe parental structure where you can ask those questions is so key.
When you got the book, like when you were reading the book, and you've now been on panels with other people who submitted it, what was that like seeing and reading and meeting other people who were sharing their stories?
So I can only read one story a day because I get like four paragraphs in and I'm a hot mess. I'm snot nose crying, but because I feel like, you know, I feel like these kids are saying things that they're wrapping words around my heart, like words that I've never been able to say or words that I didn't even know I needed to speak. They're saying it. Mm. I feel like little pieces of myself are scattered all through this book, which is why, again, I feel like it's so important that the stories get out there, because kids need to see themselves in literature, you know, and they need to see themselves in other people's stories.
Yeah. Do you think that Raised by Unicorns is coming out in a particular time where more people may be seeing this? I know that there are other books out there. Abigail Garner's Families Like Mine in 2004, or Tina Fakir-Dean's Let's Get This Straight in 2010. All of these are just really great books that are by people with LGBTQ parents. Now we're seeing some more. And does this feel like a particular moment that is right for more stories like these?
I hope so. Mm-hmm. I really hope so. Because, I mean, every story is special and it's important across every generation. I want to see lots of these books. And I see the work of Family Equality, the work of Collage. There was another book that just came out a few months ago. A photographer took, you know, rainbow families and LGBT kids and did pictures.
Yes,
and
Gabby Herman's The Kids. I'm actually in that.
Yes. Oh my gosh, yeah. That's awesome. And I saw that and I was like, yes. So again, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that this is a genre that is, because we've got the kids books, right? We've got the Heather is Two Mommies and all of that. But we don't have the piece that's kind of in the middle that says, let me educate this part of society and create a space for the kids to see themselves. You know, you guys in Collage are doing the work of getting these stories out there and making sure that, you know, you are giving them press and that people can find out about them.
That's the goal, right? Every generation should have a Raised by Unicorns and every library should have it as well.
Yes, I agree. I agree.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me. If someone picks up this book, you know, what are your hopes or wishes for them to be reading this?
I think my hope is that you can see the heart of the kids. Mm. You know, that somebody reading it can step into the kids' shoes, you know, and to put aside their theology, to put aside their politics, to put aside any worldview that would shade how they read the story, and to just very innocently read the story and let the story read them. Mm-hmm. Because I think that will then inform their place in the overarching narrative and what happens. And the other thing is, I would say is, when you run across, you know, these narratives, whether it's Raised by Unicorns, whether it is, you know, Let's Get This Straight or Families Like Mine, and then you meet a child who is the child of an LGBTQ parent, give a book to their family, like pass it on and get our stories out there. Because that's, I think, I truly believe that the stories of children are going to change the conversation for good.
Absolutely.
At least that's my hope.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jenny, thank you so much for talking with me. This was really wonderful. And I really hope everyone goes and finds Raised by Unicorns and learns a little bit more about your story and many other people's stories. And how can anybody find you if they wanted to find you on the internet?
Yeah, so I am, everything that I am branded by is Jenny Rain. So my website, which is a little out of date, is jennyrain.com. I'm on Twitter and Instagram as Jenny Rain. Thank you so much, Emily, for letting me be a part of this. And thanks to all the work that Family Equality is doing. I'm grateful to, you know, to be a part of the work that y'all are doing.
Again, thank you for joining us today. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Outspoken Voices. You can find Outspoken Voices on our website, SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. You can find Family Equality Council at familyequality.org and on Facebook and Instagram at Family Equality and on Twitter at family_equality. Until next time, remember that love, justice, family, and equality is what brings our families together.